How do you stop the feds? The first step comes from John Dickinson, the penman of the Revolution. Starting in 1767, in response to the hated Townshend Acts, John Dickinson wrote a series of 12 essays known as Letters from a Farmer in Pennsylvania. In his first, he spent time discussing the last of the acts, the New York Restraining Act. As a punishment, Parliament suspended the legislative powers of New York's Assembly for failing to fully comply with orders from the Crown. He wrote, "If the Parliament may lawfully deprive New York of any of her rights, it may deprive any or all the other colonies of their rights. And nothing can possibly so much encourage such attempts as a mutual inattention to the interests of each other. To divide, and thus to destroy, is the first political maxim in attacking those who are powerful by their union." He continued to say, in essence, that the rightful response at that moment would have been for other assemblies to pass non-binding resolutions informing Parliament that the New York Restraining Act was a usurpation of power and that it should be repealed. Why? His answer came through clearly in his signature, where he wrote the Latin phrase, "Concordia res parve crescunt." It means small things grow great by concord. Dickinson knew that passing non-binding resolutions of intent wouldn't overturn or shut down the Townshend Acts on their own, but they could act as a rallying cry for additional action in the future. Years later, that's just how his friend John Adams described the American Revolution. He wrote, "The revolution was effected before the war commenced. The revolution was in the minds and hearts of the people, a change in their religious sentiments of their duties and obligations. This radical change in the principles, opinions, sentiments, and affections of the people was the real American Revolution." Clearly, the penman of the Revolution was right. Small things did grow great in the coming years. But Dickinson wasn't alone in recognizing the importance of good strategy. In our next episode, you'll learn how Thomas Jefferson applied this same kind of approach to nullification. For nullification, Thomas Jefferson opposed an all-or-nothing strategy. In a 1799 letter to James Madison, Thomas Jefferson clarified his strategic approach to nullification. Like John Dickinson before him, Jefferson made the case that passing non-binding resolutions were an important starting point. That's exactly what Kentucky and Virginia had done the year prior when they passed the resolutions of 1798. Discussing the fact that several states had rejected the resolutions, Jefferson recommended publicly responding to those objections and further making the case that by passing the Alien and Sedition Acts, the federal government had greatly overstepped its constitutional limits. More importantly, though, Jefferson recognized their right to go further than discussion, protest, resolutions, and debate, but he advised waiting for greater consensus. He wanted to make sure they had the right amount of support before taking more aggressive action. He recommended a firm protestation against the principle and the precedent, and a reservation of the rights resulting to us from these palpable violations of the constitutional compact by the federal government, so that we may hereafter do what we might now rightfully do. This is similar to what Jefferson wrote in another letter to Madison. "I enclose you a copy of the draft of the Kentucky Resolves. I think we should distinctly affirm all the important principles they contain, so as to hold to that ground in the future and leave the matter in such a train as that we may not be committed absolutely to push the matter to extremities, and yet may be free to push as far as events will render prudent." In short, going for broke right out of the gate might be standing up for what's right, but if you don't have enough popular support, you'll never get the job done. Like the ancient Chinese proverb, we know that a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. Next up, strategy lessons from Patrick Henry and the Virginia Resolves. Resolutions drafted by Patrick Henry were the first nail in the coffin of the Stamp Act. Passed in March of 1765 in the face of intense colonial protests, the Stamp Act imposed a comprehensive schedule of taxes on all kinds of commercial and legal documents and transactions. It covered everything from wills, court actions, mortgages, insurance policies, pamphlets, newspapers, and even things like playing cards. Basically, almost every transaction requiring the use of paper required an official treasury stamp. And all the paper had to be purchased from officially approved paper distributors, chosen by the Crown. Other parts of the Act were used to chill opposition to the government, like banning the publication of any newspaper or pamphlet without the full name of the author or printer. Anonymous speech was outlawed. In just 9 days, Patrick Henry drafted and introduced 5 resolutions of strong protest against the Stamp Act. During the vigorous debates, Henry and the younger members of the Virginia House of Burgesses battled with the older, establishment ruling class. Eventually, the 5 resolutions known as the Virginia Resolves were voted on separately. The first 2 asserted the rights of every Virginian to the same time-honored liberties of all Britons. The 3rd declared the right of self-taxation as essential. The 4th asserted the right to be governed only by laws passed by their own consent and approved by their own governor. The 5th resolved that the General Assembly of this colony have the only and sole exclusive right and power to levy taxes and impositions upon the inhabitants of this colony. The first 4 passed by a 20-17 vote, and the 5th passed 20-19. An additional resolution foreshadowed nullification by declaring that Virginians were not obliged to obey laws not enacted by their assembly. But in a tactical error, Henry left for home, and on the final day of the session, the old guard not only defeated the additional resolution, they voted to rescind the first 5 as well. But even in defeat, the principles took hold. Next, we'll look at how they spread to Boston and Samuel Adams. Once word of Patrick Henry and the Virginia Resolves spread to Boston, Samuel Adams and the Loyal Nine started taking active steps to nullify the Stamp Act. In just months, Samuel Adams and the Loyal Nine were able to activate large groups of people against the Stamp Act. On August 14, 1765, a huge group hung from a Liberty Tree, an effigy of Andrew Oliver, the appointed Stamp Act distributor for Massachusetts. The crowd was so large that government officials were afraid to do anything about it. The people then cut the effigy down and started out on a mock funeral procession, chanting the slogan, "Liberty, Property, and No Stamps." They beheaded the effigy in front of Oliver's home, took it to the top of a hill, stamped it, and then burned it in a huge bonfire. The governor ordered the militia to sound the alarm, but so many drummers were part of the protests that nothing happened. The next day, a group personally visited Oliver to pressure him into resigning. And they planned to do the same with any replacement. This would make it impossible to distribute any stamped paper, and the Stamp Act would become unenforceable. What's important to note here is that even though this was considered extremely radical, there was almost no opposition to it from the people of Boston. This is because Adams and the Loyal Nine spent 2 months rallying support from merchants and the general public. And on Guy Fawkes Day that year, just 4 days after the Stamp Act went into effect, a celebration was held because the Stamp Act was still not being enforced. Adams helped expand this group into the Sons of Liberty, which were soon replicated in the other colonies. We'll cover that next. After Samuel Adams and the Loyal Nine, the Sons of Liberty took action against the Stamp Act to other colonies. Resistance to the Stamp Act began quickly in New London and Norwich, Connecticut. Resolutions urging resistance were passed at the Providence Town Meeting. Weeks later, massive crowds in Newport hung an effigy of the stamp distributor for Rhode Island. Augustus Johnson soon resigned. The hated custom collector John Robinson ordered the arrest of opposition leader Samuel Crandall, but the sheriff refused to take action. Instead, he returned the warrant, saying it was impossible to carry out safely in the current climate. Sons of Liberty groups formed in New York, South Carolina, Maryland, and elsewhere, and direct resistance continued to spread throughout the colonies. As Murray Rothbard noted in his History of the Colonial Period, Conceived in Liberty, in order to nullify the Stamp Act, the first essential act was to put the stamp masters out of commission. This was a revolutionary act that the assemblies could hardly have done openly. And by November 1765, the stamp distributors and stamped paper had been put out of action by the direct revolutionary mass action of the people. But as John Dickinson would recommend less than 2 years later, colonial assemblies also had an important role to play, backing up the people. As most people believed Virginia had done, Rhode Island passed a resolution with a call for mass disobedience. Other colonies passed resolutions opposing the Stamp Act and calling for repeal. And 27 delegates from 9 colonies formed the Stamp Act Congress, which issued a statement of principles against the Stamp Act and a formal petition to the Crown to repeal it. Other than Virginia, which was prevented from doing so by its governor, every colony approved the actions of the Congress. Once the Stamp Act went into effect, there was widespread disobedience by individuals and merchants. Even some government officials defied the act. For example, Peter Randolph, the Surveyor General of Virginia, advised all customs collectors to clear all arriving ships, even if they didn't have stamped paper. In court, a young John Adams argued that the Stamp Act was utterly void because it violated rights. He went on to say that when Parliament errs, it need not be obeyed. In the end, this combination of official declarations, mass disobedience, local resolutions, support from merchants, and non-enforcement by sheriffs and other local officials created a climate where the Stamp Act was unenforceable. Parliament ended up repealing it even though they didn't want to. This is what Rothbard called the people's nullification of the Stamp Act. Next, we'll fast forward to see how this kind of strategy has played out in modern times. The climate which led to repeal of alcohol prohibition was very similar to what led to the repeal of the Stamp Act. After passage of the 18th Amendment, nearly every state passed laws to enforce alcohol prohibition under the Volstead Act because they mistakenly believed they had an obligation to do so. Maryland, however, never passed any laws to enable state-level enforcement and was eventually joined by other states in its non-cooperation, starting with New York in 1923. A study from the University of Houston noted that by 1925, 6 states had developed laws that kept police from investigating infractions of the Federal Act. And by 1928, 28 states had stopped funding alcohol prohibition enforcement. But it wasn't just states. Cities in the Midwest and Northeast provided very little support for federal prohibition enforcement. And even when local police participated, other parts of the system couldn't or wouldn't get the job done. For example, during one period, 7,000 arrests in New York City led to just 17 convictions. Add to all this the millions of individuals who flat out defied federal law. Prior to the 18th Amendment, there were fewer than 15,000 legal bars in the United States. By 1927, more than 30,000 speakeasies were in business, and approximately 100,000 people brewed alcohol illegally at home. As the University of Houston study noted, prohibition failed because it was unenforceable. It wasn't for lack of enforcement effort on the federal level, but individuals, cities, and states resisted on a massive scale. In some cases, they even banned prohibition enforcement. Today, similar strategies are being used to nullify the federal prohibition of marijuana in practice. From individuals using or buying the plant, to businesses and employees risking prosecution to grow, transport, and sell it, millions of people are flat-out defying federal prohibition today. Supporting these efforts, as of this recording, more than 36 cities have decriminalized or legalized marijuana, while 28 states have legalized to some degree in spite of a complete federal ban. Like the response to the Stamp Act, the federal government has been unable to overcome this people's nullification and will eventually be forced to repeal. Next up, learn how similar strategies were used to nullify a federal pro-slavery law in the 1850s. In the 19th century, people used a wide range of actions to nullify the Federal Fugitive Slave Act in practice. The Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 denied a black person accused of escaping slavery any semblance of due process. A white man could basically drag a black person south into bondage on the power of his word. In response, almost every northern state passed what were known as personal liberty laws. For instance, the Michigan Personal Liberty Law prohibited slave catchers from using state or local jails to hold accused runaways. Another in Massachusetts authorized the removal of any state official who aided in the return of runaway slaves and disbarment of attorneys assisting the feds in fugitive slave rendition. Vermont's Personal Liberty Law was the most aggressive, declaring every black person within state borders free and making any attempt to take them back into slavery a kidnapping offense. These state laws were tremendously effective in impeding fugitive slave rendition. But it wasn't just legislative action. Individuals protesting, refusing to cooperate with slave catchers, and sometimes even physically intervening played an essential part. Many people participated in the Underground Railroad, defying federal law and assisting runaway slaves to freedom in Canada. This was a direct violation of federal law, punishable by 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine, the equivalent of more than $29,000 today. When runaway slave Joshua Glover's former slave master came to haul him back to Missouri, more than 2,000 people gathered in front of the Milwaukee courthouse. The crowd eventually broke him out of jail and helped him to freedom. In Syracuse, New York, jury nullification set 25 people free who helped a former slave named Jerry escape, even in the face of promises from Daniel Webster to aggressively enforce the federal act. All of these actions together drastically reduced the number of people hauled into slavery in the South and helped nullify the Fugitive Slave Act in practice. Next up, an important lesson from Rosa Parks. When Rosa Parks refused to move to the back of the bus, she taught us just how to deal with laws that are unconstitutional, immoral, or unjust. In her autobiography, Rosa Parks dispelled what were some common myths. She wrote, "People always say that I didn't give up my seat because I was tired, but that isn't true. I was not tired physically, or no more tired than I usually was at the end of a working day. I was not old, although some people have an image of me as being old then. I was 42. No, the only tired I was tired of giving in." The important lesson for us are a few things that Rosa didn't do when she was tired of giving in. She didn't first comply and then go spend a bunch of time knocking on doors, advocating for a new candidate for office in the hope that he would change the law that was oppressing her. She didn't first comply and then spend her time in an expensive and unwinnable lawsuit. Instead, she sat there and said no. From Samuel Adams and the Stamp Act resistance, to Rosa Parks' bus boycott, to more than 24 states and countless individuals defying federal prohibition today, history proves it. Saying no can change the world. individual action and resistance is really the backbone of nullification. Without it, the odds of success are reduced significantly. Next up, we'll share an example of just how things played out when a nullification effort relied almost solely on state legislation and state bureaucrats. The results have not been good. Relying solely on state legislators and bureaucrats to nullify a federal act is bad strategy. President George W. Bush signed the Real ID Act into law in 2005. It essentially co-opts the states into creating a national ID system. Every state was supposed to comply with the provisions in Real ID by May 2008, but states refused for various reasons, including privacy concerns and the fact that Congress didn't provide any funding for the mandate. Many states passed resolutions opposing it, while others simply ignored it, and some passed laws expressly prohibiting implementation of the federal act. The feds pushed hard, but found coercing unwilling states wasn't so easy. Year after year, the feds claimed it would be the last chance to comply. But every year, the states wouldn't budge, and the feds moved the deadline to the following year. From the beginning, the feds threatened that people living in non-compliant states wouldn't be able to use their driver's licenses to get through TSA security at airports. Former Montana Governor Brian Schweitzer, a Democrat, famously said the federal government can go to hell back in the spring of 2008, calling the no-fly threat another bluff from some bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. In January 2007, the Maine legislature overwhelmingly passed a resolution opposing implementation of Real ID. Utah followed suit a month later, and other states such as New Hampshire did the same. By October 2009, 25 states had approved either resolutions or binding legislation refusing to cooperate. But the feds kept pushing, and the fortitude of the states began to fade. In many cases, most of the legislators who led the resistance were no longer in office, and the new blood didn't seem to have any problems submitting to this federal mandate. Idaho is a prime example. In 2008, Governor Otter signed a law saying Real ID was inimical to the security and well-being of the people of Idaho. It flat-out prohibited the state from implementing the federal act. But in 2016, Otter signed another bill into law, overturning the prohibition and beginning the implementation process. A similar thing happened in at least six states in 2016 alone. But one state did manage to stop Real ID in 2016 because of aggressive action at the grassroots level. A Real ID compliance bill sailed through the Kentucky legislature after Governor Matt Bevin said he supported the move. But when people ratcheted up the pressure on the governor, he reversed course and vetoed it. The lesson is clear. Relying on state governments to unilaterally nullify federal acts without public pressure, including protest and even non-compliance, is not an effective strategy. Next up, how jury nullification can protect people even in the face of federal arrests. Jury nullification is the last line of defense and can turn around even the worst situation. In 1843, a man named Jerry escaped slavery in Missouri and made his way to New York. His birth name was William Henry, and he was 40 years old. He lived free in Syracuse for 8 years before he was arrested in 1851 under the Federal Fugitive Slave Act. Syracuse was an abolitionist hotspot, the great central depot of the Underground Railroad. Earlier that year, the hated Secretary of State Daniel Webster had warned that the law would be enforced even here in Syracuse, in the midst of the next anti-slavery convention. Jerry's arrest was considered a message from the federal government that it would aggressively enforce the locally unpopular law. But the people there were not intimidated by Webster's federal threat, and Jerry had a lot of local support. An immediate effort to free Jerry helped him escape to the street in irons, but he was quickly recaptured. He was then relocated to a more secure room, but a crowd of 2,500 people surrounded the building, and reports said they overwhelmed them by numbers, not by blows. Jerry was brought to a safe house, and a few days later, he made his way to freedom in Canada. The federal government put 26 people on trial for helping him escape, but only one person was convicted. That's because they couldn't seat a jury in the area willing to do anything but acquit. Turning the tables, the rescuers actually got a state law indictment against Marshall Allen for kidnapping Jerry, and used the occasion to argue against the constitutionality of the fugitive slave law. While Allen wasn't sent to prison either, the entire episode shows how people used various tools to block the practical effect of the pro-slavery federal act in Syracuse. Next, we'll talk about how to put all these different ideas into a big picture strategy. Nullification is most effective when approached with a combination of strategies. As we learned from both Patrick Henry and John Dickinson, resolutions affirming specific principles can be an important starting point. And as we discussed in more detail last season, this was the same approach Thomas Jefferson and James Madison took with the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions of 1798. They were intended as a first step. Whatever the first step may be, a winning strategy needs more than one step. It requires approaching the issue from various directions. We've seen this employed effectively against everything from the Stamp Act in 1765 to alcohol and marijuana prohibition in modern times. From this experience, we can use four main principles to build an effective strategy against federal programs today. 1. Education. Non-binding resolutions bring the issue to the forefront of the public discussion and can set a principled foundation for further action. John Dickinson called on colonial assemblies to do this in support of New York against the Townsend Acts. The Stamp Act Congress took the same approach. Patrick Henry's Virginia Resolves did the same, but also included a strong call to action by the people. And the resolutions of 1798 were considered a starting point by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. 2. Individual action and resistance. As we've learned from the Real ID Act of 2005, even the strongest resolutions and state laws don't stand much of a chance if the general public simply complies with a federal act. However, official actions from state or local governments can move widespread individual resistance into the winning column. 3. Official noncompliance. While not widespread, a refusal to enforce the Stamp Act by various government agents helped bolster efforts already happening in the general public. The same thing has happened in modern times, with cities and states standing down on both alcohol and marijuana prohibition, creating a climate where a full federal repeal becomes inevitable. 4. Jury nullification. Arrest sometimes goes hand in hand with resistance. A full-spectrum nullification strategy accepts this, deals with it, and uses jury nullification to minimize the harm done. Fully informed juries are the last line of defense and can set people free even after arrest. In recent years, more than 24 states have passed non-binding resolutions rejecting federal overreach. In most situations, it's time to move forward to more direct action. As we covered last season, Thomas Jefferson advised pushing as far as events will render prudent. Next, stay tuned for part two of this series, where we'll share with you just how to put this strategy into practice today.